talk with George Norrie, call the Wildcard Line at area code 818-501-4109. The first time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with George toll free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach George Norrie by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
You know, like the Mayans, the Hopis also talk about the possibility of a pole shift, sort of a flipping of the planet on its axis. Will that ever happen? And then what does that mean? We'll be back with more and your phone calls with our guest, Daniel Pinchback, on Coast to Coast AM. I had read, Daniel, that Turtle Island, one of the Fijis, that the Hopis said that if it turned over two or three times, the oceans could join hands and meet the sky. Some say that that could mean a prophecy of a pole shift. Some of the Hopi prophecies, of course, did include Earth changes. Have you looked at that one at all?
Haven't really looked at that one. I guess I've just been approaching it from a more kind of psychic perspective.
Type.
I mean, the John Major Jenkins, who writes about 2012 from the Mayan perspective, he thinks that this astronomical alignment they're looking at is actually a kind of movement across the galactic equator, which might have sort of like we cross over the midline of the Milky Way across through the Stark Rift, and that might have effects on a kind of psychophysical level, just as, you know, there's effects below and above the equator now, that currents run differently, you know, water flows in the other direction and so on. So, you know, who knows? I mean, I strongly feel that the essential element is that it's a change in the nature of consciousness, but that a change in the nature of consciousness can only be accomplished consciously. Can't be accomplished unconsciously. Therefore, the work that we have to do is very powerful and direct up until that time, which is to somehow pull ourselves into alignment and then work to get the planet into a harmonic state.
The shamans that practice what they practice, how did they become what they are, shamans? How did that happen?
Some of them are born into shamanic families, but a lot of them go through spontaneous initiations. They'll be sick, they'll begin to receive visions, they'll learn that the only way to cure the sickness is for themselves to become a shaman. Sometimes also people get struck by lightning and are instantly dosed with a hit of shamanic knowledge. So there are a bunch of different ways.
Let's go to some calls. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Oh, hi, you all. I'm calling because I would like to see our government make some changes. I'm an herbalist of sorts, and I think the plants do have a fine medicine for all of us, as you, Daniel, have hinted. Now, as I understand it, one of the things that you did that was not talked about too much on this program was when you went to West Africa, you came with in contact with an herb called Ivotabernath. Is that how you pronounce it?
Something like that, yeah.
James Arthur had turned me on to that, but he said, you know, our country has made it a Schedule 1, meaning you can't use it. But it's not addictive, and yet it would cure people from the alcohol problems, the various bad drug problems like cocaine and heroin and so forth.
How does it work?
Actually, I don't think that it's a cure. I mean, it's a treatment, and it's a very powerful treatment tool. It might actually be the most powerful treatment tool, but it really is a tool. It's not a cure. And it seems to work in different ways. I mean, it actually seems to, it's a very long trip, Iboga, and it's very psychological in that you process a lot of past material. It also has a kind of cynical sense of humor to it, which is kind of tough. It's like sort of tough love, you know. But it also seems to have a kind of biochemical level in which it either reintegrates the brain hemispheres, that's one theory, or it resets the addiction receptors, so that people who are addicted to opiates especially, after one Ibogaine treatment, no longer have craving, don't really have much in the way of withdrawal symptoms, and have an opportunity to kind of change their life pattern. But the opportunity, you know, still comes back to where they're at. I mean, if they go back into their old habits, into their old mindset, they'll end up back in the same place with the drugs. But at least it gives people a few months to make a change in their life pattern if they're ready for that.
You know, I sometimes think that this planet has the ability to give us all cures and, in this particular case, maybe allow us to reach into the other realms that we couldn't normally.
Right. I mean, I think that the future, in a way, is going to be post-technological, in that we're going to become much more interested in the, you know, possibility of creating a kind of garden planet with using technology much more sparingly and stripping away a lot of the technosphere that we've already created.
Indeed. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on the air with Daniel Pinchback. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Leonard calling from Gadsden, Alabama on WAAX Wax Radio.
Welcome to the program, Leonard.
Or as I say over here, I have wax in my ears. Okay, I have three quick questions for your guest, please, relating to tobacco. Was tobacco smoking ever involved in a religious ceremony? Are there negative, positive spirits involved with tobacco? And what positive method is there in using tobacco spiritually?
Tobacco is actually one of the most sacred plants of North and South American shamanism. I mean, obviously, you know about the pipe rituals in North American Indian cultures. And in South America, it's actually used, they use a very powerful strain, Nicotina rustica, I think it's called, and they'll make potent shakes out of it, of tobacco juice, which they'll then drink and become unconscious.
Oh, my.
And go out and see visions. It's also used synergistically with ayahuasca. I mean, it's definitely a major shamanic intoxicant.
Must be a lot of things on this planet that that they have at their disposal.
Yeah.
Next up, let's go west of the Rockies. Thanks for that call. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good evening, gentlemen. This is a great show.
Well, thank you. And where are you calling from first?
I'm calling from Gold Hill in Oregon.
Okay.
And I have a question. I studied briefly shamanism with Michael Harner. Daniel, you're familiar with him?
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed when I was studying with Michael, and also I did some soul retrieval, that I would have amazing synchronicity coming up all the time in my life, you know, coincidences. So, and, you know, the rational mind kind of says, oh, it's just, you know, don't pay any attention to it. But I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about, my feeling was that it was sort of non-ordinary reality, uh-huh, sort of manifesting for guidance.
Yeah, I mean, synchronicities are definitely a huge element that I'm talking about in the book that I'm finishing. Well, it's in the last book, too. But, you know, Carl Jung talked about them as being revealing kind of a causal ordering principle to reality. And they're giving us this clue that time is not just this kind of straightforward linear projection that the material culture proposes. It's actually synchronized and linked to the evolution of consciousness. So I think that, and it really became a kind of experiential, ontological method for me to sort of follow synchronicities deeper and deeper and to really stay with them. Then if you sort of get too excited about them, they tend to fade away. So you have to sort of approach them with a certain level of calm detachment and yet realize that they're indicating certain kind of flows, you know.
So you have to kind of fact-check your synchronicity then.
Exactly. I think that you have to learn a kind of weird, I mean, that's where, you know, it's about balancing the intuitive and the rational mind. You know, first, you know, you realize that this is going on, and then you sort of try to find a way to work with it as a new kind of paradigm of reality. But that's totally also what the Mayan calendar is about. The whole calendar, they have this 260-day grid where each day is a tone. And by knowing your birth date, you get a tone, and then you're part of this whole, like, tonal harmonic structure, which is all about, you know, synchronicities and resonances across the structure.
Okay, so there's something to pay attention to, but also to keep some sort of checking going on in your life. Like, I notice they come up more when I'm in turmoil.
Right, right. I mean, that's classic. I mean, it's like the kind of new pattern, the new sort of psychic pattern is constellating, and that's when synchronicities tend to kind of proliferate, you know. And, I mean, you have to pick and choose, you know.
Okay, thank you.
Don't take every door. Okay. Yeah, sure.
Thank you for being part of the program. let's move next to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Hannah from Seattle.
Hello, Hannah.
And hi, I've read your book, Mr. Pinchbeck, Breaking Open the Head, and I was wondering, you said you had an experience in DMT where you met certain like entities, or at least entities were involved in, you know, talking to you through your consciousness or whatever. I mean, I guess that's what I got from it. And I was wondering, what were these entities like, and what did you feel their intentions were?
Right. Well, I mean, at this point, I've had a lot of different experiences like this, and in fact, since the finishing of the last book, like the sort of ayahuasca and ibogaine experiences became very like message oriented, which really surprised me. Like the last ayahuasca session in Brazil, there were these, I felt like I was communing with these kind of cosmic thought beings, and they put this phrase in my mind, which I then had to like reach for my notebook, even in my stone state, to write it down, and it was, you go deeper into the physical to get to the infinite. When I took ibogaine, there was a series of communications. It was almost like a journalistic interview where I would ask questions. And my friend was also doing it at the same time. This was not in Africa. This was in a clinic in Mexico. A friend of mine was doing it at the same time. And for instance, he had an experience where, you know, he was sort of thinking to himself, oh, how can I help humanity? What can I do to save civilization? And this answer came roaring back in his head, clean up your room. So, you know, it seems like on that level, the entities have been pretty accurate. I did have one experience that I described in the book on a substance called DPT, dipropyltryptamine, that was more kind of diabolic or demonic or trickstery. It wasn't really verbal communication, but it was the sense of a kind of shadowy figure kind of, you know, sort of tailing me, and then I began to have poltergeist phenomena in my house. It kind of opened me up to this whole occult realm that I hadn't really believed in until that point.
Of the shamans that are around different cultures on this planet, they've been, of course, the Australian tribes, Brazil, every place.
Yeah.
Is there one group a little more advanced than the other, Daniel?
Well, I think the shamanism, you know, I mean, that's what I said in Breaking Open the Head. It's a universal human phenomenon. And I don't know if you can really talk about advanced. I mean, I think that the Mayan culture was the full flowering of the shamanic consciousness. It was kind of the shamanic visionary perspective elaborated, you know, as profoundly as the Tibetan Buddhist elaborated their sacred culture. So I guess that was the most advanced that there's been. I mean, it also seems like there are different sort of, it's almost like, I mean, in the Kabbalah, they talk about the God had scattered kind of sparks or shards around the world, so that had to be kind of picked back up and put back together. It's like there are different pieces and elements in all these different cultures that we can now recombine. And that includes, you know, the different sacred plants, like working with the African plant and ayahuasca. I mean, that's something that wasn't available to people before, you know, the last couple decades.
All right, let's move on to our wild card line. Where are you calling from? You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yes, hi. Am I on?
Yes, sir.
Great. My name is Ruben. I'm calling from San Francisco.
Yeah,
and I had a couple of quick comments about, one was about the calendar, the Mayan calendar. In 1582, I believe, we lost 10 days. The calendar jumped from October 4th to October 15th. So that got me wondering that if the end of the Mayan calendar is December 21st, it might actually be December 31st, which is New Year's, and which is a day for a lot of celebrations. Comment about that. Then my other quick comment is crop circles seem to possibly be messages from our future selves that we're sending back through time. As if sending email messages through time rather than through space. And my comment about that. And then third thing.
I've already
forgotten the first one, to be honest. Was the first comment about?
About the okay. the calendar date possibly.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I just wanted to say, too,
that shop properly. I mean, you know, but, you know, it's all, when you look at these different interpretations, I mean, one thing that's really become more and more clear, I mean, this is what I was trying to say about what the crop circles taught me about the nature of reality, is that truth is not an absolute. I mean, Nietzsche said that, you know, maybe it's just our, you know, ridiculous, you know, this dualistic idea, there's a truth and a falsity. Maybe truth is more like levels of values, like a painter uses in a painting. You know, so we have to get off these kind of dualistic, I mean, we're trying to move into a more non-dualistic framework for thinking. So we have to get off this dualistic, like truth, non-truth. I mean, you know, when you look at these different readings of the Mayan material, they're all slightly different. Just like Arguelles proposes his slightly different calendar. But when you put it all together, you know, it's just like looking at occult cosmologies in general. There's always a differentiation. It's like different kinds of Baroque music or different composers or something. But then you pick up the whole pattern and you realize that there's this incredible thing being revealed there. But there, once again, it requires an integration of intuitive and rational consciousness.
How did we get the 2012 date from the Mayan calendar? Was that deciphered? Was it decoded?
Yeah, deciphered. It's all over the place. And it's also... I mean, according to Jenkins, it's all over their sculptures too, because they're constantly pointing to the plane of the ecliptic and the Milky Way and the sort of orientation of the ball courts. I mean, he did an amazing job sort of putting all this information together in his book Maya Cosmogenesis 2012, so that the whole civilization for 1,000 years. Or more, was oriented, Toltec and Mayan, towards establishing this particular date, this event that they knew was going to take place. And he actually talks about how there were two different traditions that then came together and integrated at Chichen Itza. So Chichen Itza represented the kind of integration of two thought streams that for 1,000 years have been trying to establish this exact end date and how it was going to take place.
Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing? This is Colin from Seattle.
Hello, Colin. Welcome.
I have a couple comments and a question for Daniel about the Mayan prophecies that was written by Maurice Claudereau and some of his work. First, I'd like to just thank you for the show. This is awesome. This is something I've been waiting for a long time.
You are welcome.
And some of the verbiage that he's been using is the same stuff that I talk about to my friends when I'm trying to explain them the dynamics of the underlying structure in the universe and consciousness.
And what do they say? Language. What do they say when you talk that way? They understand you?
Well, sometimes they do. Sometimes it's just like throwing a brick off a wall. But, you know, that's their level of awareness, and it's not their time yet, and hopefully...
What's your question?
I want to know your opinion of some of the work that Maurice Claudereau did down in Palenque with Bacall's tomb and some of the stuff that he found, and referencing that to he also wrote a book called the Tutankhamun Prophecies,
right,
and Viscocha in Peru. And
I had mixed
about all of that stuff.
I had mixed feelings when I saw him give a presentation and read some of his material. It seemed a little bit kind of Carnival Barker-ish. Like, I felt like I was reading P.T. Barnum or something. It's got a little bit of that shamanic trickster element to it. However, some of the picture material where he basically took these, I can't remember his whole system.
They're like overlays pieces. Or something. Yeah.
What's that?
He had them in an overlay fashion.
Exactly, and then he saw there was some kind of angle. There could be something there, perhaps. You know, but once again, as I would say, truth is not absolute. And to him, for me, it seemed a little bit more on the kind of trickster level.
Is your approach more scientific or more metaphysical?
I think the universe is a great work of art.
All right. Who's the artist?
We all are.
Yeah.
If we want to be.
We should be. Some are good artists, some are bad.
Well, let's try to be good artists.
Absolutely. And I don't mean just by spirituality. Some of us just should try a little bit better at the talent to do that. And, you know, I think they could make a change.
Yeah. But I think my method is scientific in a strange way. I mean, because it's like, but it's scientific rooted in subjectivity, you know, rather than, I mean, and that also seems to be where quantum physics has kind of ended up, that there isn't even a place for an objective observer. You know, as John Archibald Wheeler said, you know, it's a participant universe. Everybody is participating. And I think that's where we're sort of realizing more and more. And once again, that comes down to what I was saying about the crop circles, that it's about understanding that the nature of reality is subjective. And what you bring to the table is what gets reflected back to you.
Stay with us. We'll be back. We'll wrap up the half hour with more of your phone calls. I'm George Norrie with our special guest tonight, Daniel Pinchbeck, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
Get it in writing with the After Dark Newsletter. Subscribe by calling 1-888-727-5505. With George Norrie, call the Wildcard line at area code 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with George toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach George Norrie by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
The dream that you dare to, oh why can't I?
That's Brother Iz, by the way, I-Z, those of you who just love that song. You know, he was Hawaiian. I talked about him a little bit when I was in Hawaii over the weekend, and he was a huge person, 500-some pounds, died in his 30s, and he was, and still is, very sorely missed out there because he performed well. They used to have to get him, in order to get him up on a stage, because he's so big, they had to get almost like one of these crane-type things to get him up on the stage, where he then performed for everybody. But what a great talent he was. His music, of course, lives forever. Hey, would you like to become a member of the Filament Book Club? So many people are now. This is a book club that allows you to download books electronically. Now, you say, well, what do you mean electronically? I don't have the ability to do that. Oh, yes, you do, because when you become a member of the Filament Book Club, they will send you a free electronic book. Call 1-888-95-EBOOK or go to their website, which is right at the bottom of coasttocoastam.com. You'll see it there, filamentbookclub.com. Go right back to the phones with our guest, Daniel Pinchback. Let's go to our wild card line. First of all, you're up. Hi, where are you calling from?
Hello, George.
Yes, sir.
Hi, it's Evan from Ventura.
Evan, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Daniel, I have a couple questions for you real quick. I first want to say that I think the psychedelic experience has obviously been, you know, vastly demonized by our current culture, and probably has a place for individuals in a therapeutic setting. But that being said, that the examples you've given of the flowering of shamanic society, whether Mayan or Tibetan, don't necessarily point to a very successful or positive outcome for the integration of this kind of culture to advance humanity. The Mayans certainly disappeared either because of ecological mismanagement or constant warfare, at least that's the common theory, also practiced a great deal of human sacrifice and blood ritual, and basic sort of religious theocratic domination of their society. The Tibetans, though, you know, the Dalai Lama is a pretty groovy guy and all, still sort of would adhere to a political theocracy, the idea of a selection of a god king from an exclusively male Tibetan ethnic stock. And the lamaseries themselves were built mostly of conscript labor, not really a real advanced society from the humanistic standpoint.
Well, I think that's why, you know, we have to look at humanity as an evolutionary process, you know, and I think, like, you know, in a way that's also for me, like, the meaning of Christ and Christianity, which is not ever really quite taken as probably to the extent it should, but that was, you know, but the moral of that is to kind of, you know, sacrifice to create a truly human world. And I think you're a little bit exaggerating the Mayan situation from what I know about them. And I think it's an interesting possibility that the classical Mayan civilization ended when they had fulfilled their mission, which was to leave this information about time behind for us to pick up. And I also think that, you know, we don't really know what the hierarchical situation there was. I mean, artists were definitely very highly prized in that culture. You know, it may have been a much more happy situation compared to what else was available in the world at that point. And, you know, the Tibetans, you know, I mean, I went to Dharamsala and I could see the incredible reverence and joy that the ordinary Tibetans got from the Dalai Lama. So, you know, those may not be perfect civilizations, but I think we have to see that we're in an evolving process, and where we're trying to sort of, you know, put the hemispheres together, and that's why also I think the Hopis are an interesting example in that they seem to have been completely anti-authoritarian and non-hierarchical. One way to look at this whole 2012 thing also is Arguelles talks a lot about the nuosphere, which is sort of the mind of the planet, which may involve a kind of collective telepathic synchronization, which may make a lot of things available to us which are not now available to us.
Still with us?
I think those are really good answers. I think as far as the Maya go, there is substantial evidence they either suffered an ecological disaster based on their farming techniques that they couldn't get their way out of.
I don't think that's clear at all. That's Jared Diamond's perspective. But I mean, there are some of the Mayan farming techniques are now being revived, being rediscovered and revived because they turned out to be ecologically very sound. I think it was a very clever civilization, and that we've actually imposed our modern materialist perspective that there had to be this particular reason for a collapse. And I think that, as I said, they may have just checked out at a certain point when they fulfilled their goal, which was to build these civilizations, which then actually had to disappear so they could be rediscovered in a certain time sequence. I mean, they were obsessed with time and synchronicity and harmonization. That was like the basis of their whole culture.
All right. I don't think there's a lot of archaeological evidence to back that up, but I certainly accept that as a viewpoint. I guess where I was more sort of going is that the psychedelic experience is a fascinating state of consciousness. I think if we're going to push it forward as a way to change and integrate society, there needs to be a more concrete model. And I think looking around the world today, you see a tremendous amount of negative impact brought by adherence to spirituality and particularly to theocracy. And maybe we need to steer away from mystic states and start looking at more rational-centered ideas for changing societies on the planet.
Well, I don't think, I don't think mysticism and rationality are mutually exclusive. In fact, I think they can be integrated. And I think that we don't see a lot of problems from esoteric disciplines. We don't see a lot of problems from, you know, yogis and Sufis and, even modern-day shamans. We see problems from, fundamentalist religions and monotheistic, antiquated patriarchal systems, and those probably, you know, are fundamentally flawed and are not going to be capable of sustaining themselves through this transition.
Let's go east of the Rockies. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Daniel.
Hi.
This is Jim from Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Daniel, I wanted to ask you, someone else asked you about verbiage, and something you, a phrase you used earlier was our sick Western condition. Now, I assume you use a computer and that you've flown to all these places you've been to, and these are products of our sick Western condition, whereas these people you visited are happy to take their psychedelics and defecate in trenches and live in hovels. Is that what you wish for us?
Well, I mean, first of all, it seems to me that you're coming with a huge amount of cultural baggage. You're talking about them defecating in trenches and living in hovels. Actually, the only people who are defecating in trenches or living in hovels are those who've been subjected to our sick Western mentality and the conditions we've imposed upon the planet. When I went to visit the tribe, the Sequoia were still living in the rainforest. I saw some of their ancestral dwellings, and they were sort of like rainforest cathedrals. I mean, the most harmonic structures that have ever been inside. And so I think that's a huge imposition on your part. I mean, yeah, I would say that our sick Western condition is basically a kind of mass soul loss, incapacity to confront the consequences of our own actions, and something that we're needing as individuals and collectively to take responsibility for. And I would say what's happening right now is a collective shadow projection, as Jung would say, where we are constantly blaming the other. We're constantly talking about defecating in the trenches. I mean, where does the defecation in New York go? It's put on a barge and shipped somewhere else. You know, I mean, we're constantly in a projection mode, and our technology is also involved in that. So I think we need to fundamentally rethink the basis of our civilization. Yeah.
But you're happy to use the technology, aren't you?
You use the system that exists to create the system that you want to be.
Okay, Jim. Thank you for your call. Let's move up next to our first time caller line. Welcome to the show. Hi there.
Hi, this is Joe from Cliff Village.
That's in Missouri, isn't it?
Yep,
I remember
Missouri.
That. Sure thing.
I'm an ayahuascaro from Cliff Village here. And I had a question at the end of this, but I wanted to tell you about an experience I had real quick. And it's funny that you mentioned the whole idea of us being great artists before the break, because I believe that the paradigm shift in the hemispheres of the brain really ties to a swinging of the polarity between the old idea of a warrior hero, the Achilles-type warrior hero, to more of an artisan hero, more of a shamanic music maker, an entertainer, someone who can invoke joy. And that's really the idea behind a lot of stuff McKenna was talking about bringing physical things into existence, was actually the act of invoking that joy in people. And I say this because I was, for most of my life, I was a I raised a football player, went into the Navy, did a bunch of was really gung-ho for destruction. And then on May the 5th of the year 2000, I had an experience where some people came together and I was administered LSD, mushrooms, and pretty high amounts of marijuana. And at some point in time in the night, everybody came together and basically told me what a tried egomaniac I was and said, this is the point when you die on acid. And when they said this, they pointed their fingers at me and everything in the room stopped. And there were six old men standing in the corner who were saying, grandson, your life isn't going very good this way. You need to do something different. And I saw what looked like arrows come from the directions and like from the sky and from the ground and shot into my heart. And I basically began a spiritual journey that ended me up in London, England, and under another...
That's a nice story, but do you have a question?
Yeah, well, my question is actually... I was actually going to say something about the idea of using something spiritually as far as better than using it recreationally. You know, there are two ways to use a substance. Jesus used alcohol spiritually, not recreationally. Tobacco is used spiritually. It can, when you use something recreationally, you really open yourself up to a lot of negative recourse. But my question really was, do you think there should be emerging not only of Eastern ideologies in the form of Kriya Yoga meditation type type research along with shamanic plants, and not only from the east to the west. What do you think about merging the Mesoamerican Indian cultures, the Ayahuasqueros, with the peyote, peyote sweat?
Hello?
You there?
Yeah. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
I've been working with a teacher, and she's actually been bringing people from the Native American church down to South America to introduce them to the ayahuasca traditions. So I think that's an interesting way to go.
How much time do we have left? A couple more calls. Let's pick it up by going to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, good morning, George. This is Jason calling in from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, Jason.
Hi. I also follow the 13-moon, 28-day calendar.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask your guest somewhat about the symbolism. I'm a red spectral Skywalker, which from my point of origin sort of defines my life as a world time traveler, as I understand, and seems to appear throughout my life. But I was briefly to explain, if you could explain some of the symbolism between the solar seeds and...
It's actually not my area of specialty. I mean, and as I was saying, although I appreciate the 13-moon calendar, and I think it has its own validity, I was mapped onto it like very elegantly when I met Arguelles. I think what's ultimately going to be necessary is a kind of a sort of meeting of minds to create a new timing frequency that actually could be generally applicable for the planet and would help us move into a kind of new framework. I mean, I think Arguelles did a fundamentally amazing thing by sort of recognizing that such a tool, such an instrument could be of value. But I think there's another stage that it needs to be taken to.
If we did that, what's the benefit for it? I mean, what would
happen? Right, well, first of all, we would resynchronize with natural time. It would be a meeting of scientific minds and spiritual traditions. So in itself would be a kind of concord. It would be a kind of making a kind of
harmonic
new concordance.
Yeah.
And then it would have the fabulous benefit of delegitimizing all of the nation state charters and institutions that currently exist. So we'd be able to start again, hopefully from a global harmonic paradigm. But obviously this is a very idealistic perspective, unless this whole idea of the noosphere is correct, and as we come into alignment with that, it may become possible for us to think in these ways, breaking down dualism.
We've got a calendar system, Daniel, which is much like our monetary system, where we don't have gold backing it anymore; they just keep making it and making
it. Exactly, it's all part of the same process.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah.
My question is about the. Like salvia divinorum, and if it was used in sacrificial rituals, like I heard that, like
in sacrificial or sacramental. I mean, I don't think it was used sacrificial.
Like I heard it was used, like they made the people smoke it, and then like when they thought their soul left their body, they sacrificed it.
Well, I never heard that. I mean, all I know is that it was used by the Mazatec Indians, who seems very peaceful to me when I visited them.
How powerful was that?
I've done it a few times, and it's quite powerful. I mean, you can do it different ways. The thing that's interesting about salvia is that it's like a completely different experience than any other psychedelic, and it's almost like gives you a totally different perception of time and space. It's sort of like you normally feel that it's almost like orthogonal. It's like you're moving into some like diagonal direction from our normal time and space, and it really, for me, it's like it's an incredible indicator of how much, you know, is left to be discovered. And I really think that the hyper-dimensional object that physicists are working on and looking at is ultimately the psyche. And these different compounds and techniques are ways of kind of traversing this object at different trajectories, which give you, you know, lead you into different relationships, different beings appear. I mean, here we have a realm for post-history, you know, for where we'll go after 2012, where we have, you know, millions of years ahead of exploration.
Do you think 2012 is the strike date? That's the date we should all be interested in, concerned about?
No, I think we better be concerned about it right now.
That's what I thought.
That's why I'm trying to do this magazine project, Medicine. You know, what I see is that there are all these systems and ideas that have been developing, you know, since the 60s, a lot of them beyond, like how to use
organic material to kind of bioremediate toxified land using mushrooms or living machines made of microorganisms, creating new currencies that instill like a different value system through an economy. So you could actually have a currency that instilled a compassionate value systems. I think there's a whole bunch of ideas that have been developed that could be put together as a paradigm and then implemented as this current paradigm begins to self-destruct.
All right. Well, the website, of course, is breakingopenthehead.com. This is a book, Breaking Open the Head, A Psychedelic Journey to the Heart of Contemporary Shamanism. What will the title be? Do you have a title yet for the second book?
Well, I assume it'll be 2012, subtitled The Return of Quetzalcoatl.
Okay. So
Thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Okay, Daniel. Take care. Daniel Pinchbeck is his name. If you need to go to his website, of course, it's linked up with coasttocoastam.com. And I, of course, fresh back from a two-day jaunt in Hawaii where we had just a great event out there with the people at KHVH and all of you, of course, who attended. And I tell you, first time in Hawaii, and what a gorgeous state we have over there. Our guest tomorrow, by the way, first hour, Richard C. Hoagland, is going to talk a little bit about Coral Castle, Saturn, and Mars. And then our main guest, Dr. David Humes, as we talk about mysticism and intuition. And then on Wednesday, the great debate, James McCanney and Dr. David Morrison, as they battle it out over the theories of Velikovsky. For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Ladasur, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.